As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello everyone, I'm Carl Anker and welcome to Talk of the Devils. This is a dedicated Manchester United podcast from The Athletic. Today, we are going to go over 120 minutes of pretty drab football and 22, or at least 21, very impressive penalties. Manchester United lost the Europa League final against Villarreal on Wednesday night. It was weird. It was strange. I've got Laurie Whitwell and Andy Mitten with me, reporting from their wonderful hotel rooms in Gdansk, Poland. I'm going to start with you, Laurie. Laurie, how are you feeling?
Tired. You know, we talk about players having fatigue. What about the journalists? World's smallest violin there. I'm all right. Me and Andy discovered we're in the same hotel last night on the taxi on the way back, which was nice. But yeah, it's one of those where you come away from the game and, you know, you've got to write a piece that it wasn't really the piece you thought you were going to write. You know, we had something prepared if United had won. It's difficult to get straight into it. A match report is one thing. You can kind of, you know, if you go into a game knowing you need to do a match report and you sort of write the run of play and you know, you do a top and it's fine. To analyse it is a bit different. And I needed to take some time away. Had a bit of a chat with a couple of lads at a bar outside in Gdansk. There's United fans were still out. Good spirits, to be fair. Just having a few chilled beers, I think. Then got back, had a beer with a couple of other guys that are staying in the hotel and then got to write. So I think I'm currently on about 3 hours sleep. It was 5 a.m. local time by the time I went to bed. Sunlight outside, but it's you know, we get such privilege doing this kind of job, and it was a special thing to actually be there last night. So I'm very, you know, grateful for that. But yeah, there is another side to the job as well. So hopefully I can stay awake for the rest of this podcast.
It was an excellent piece, as is yours, Andy, covering it a little bit from the Villarreal side. Did it sting writing about how happy the Villarreal fans might be today?
Like Laurie, I'm tired and I'm gutted. And that piece was put on me right at the last minute. And it was, in the event of Villarreal winning, can you write 800 words about that? And I'm thinking, well, I'm already completely up against it. But yeah, I will do it because you just have to do it. But I was also thinking, I won't need to do it. I said to Laurie an hour before the game, I'm 60% confident that United will win. And I think Laurie said, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by 60%? What if it was 20%? And I just said, I think United are favourites, but Villarreal are good. I've watched them a lot this year. And I ended up at 2 a.m. sending a message to a man I'd met last week in Villarreal who really left an impression on me about his background story, about his son passing away. And I was happy for him, gutted for United, gutted for the travelling fans, for the players. I spoke to Ollie after the game. There was a real sadness in his eyes, even though what he said made sense. And not had any sleep, and it's raining in Gdansk, and Laurie and I have got a view over, like, no, it's not the... Never be on a postcard of Gdansk to it. I'm disappointed. Your Villarreal coloured fleece has brightened me up, Carl. I've got to say that. So cheers for that, mate.
Let's get into this game then. Both of you were in Gdansk. You're in the stadium covering things. I was watching on television. I just about managed to watch that shootout through pained eyes. How did it end up going to penalty shootouts, Laurie? What happened over that 90 minutes?
it wasn't a good performance by Manchester United overall, was it? There was a moment in the second half where it felt like they'd got the momentum. They were attacking Villarreal with something that was strangely absent in the first half. It seemed that they expected the game just to go their way ultimately. It was too slow around the back. There wasn't enough incision. And Villarreal, you know, their structure, their shape could repel it pretty straightforwardly. You know, United were the better team, I would say, but it took, you know, Mason Greenwood to take on his marker on the right to kind of create a chance. The moments that United had success were when the players got the ball, you know, did something with it or injected a bit of urgency into the passing. Whereas there were times aside from that where it looked like they just, as I say, expected the game to go their way. A set piece, Villarreal, again, another set piece. Victor Lindelof, should he block off the guy better? Gerrard, should Luke Shaw track him better? It was a sharp run, clearly. It was a good ball into the box. Could De Gea have done better? It just felt another one of those set piece situations that were too easy for the opposition to score. I did think that they came out better in the second half. So clearly, again, you know, you've written about it, Carl, the comeback that United have within them. I think they do say good stuff to them at halftime, useful stuff, because they came out and it was fortunate with the goal. Yeah, so people can still criticise United and say there was two shots on target all game, and the goal that, you know, United scored was a deflection and fell fortuitously for Cavani to score. I still think United deserved to get the equaliser at that stage. In the stadium, I'm sort of reminded that when you're in the stadium and the VAR's happening and you've got fans and nobody knows what's going on, it's that sort of idiosyncrasy that we'd kind of forgotten about, I suppose, with fans being out. But and then when it got confirmed that he was onside, there was such a, you know, Bruno turned to the fans and was whipping up the crowd, and they set off from that kickoff like hares racing around a track, and it looked like they'd really got the bit between their teeth. And then it sort of just eventually, as the game wore on, dissipated. And clearly an extra time was pretty much a waste of time, really. That was a sort of awkward situation where it was Solskjaer trying to figure out who he was going to put on, clearly with a mind on penalties at the end of it, which I'm a little bit concerned about. You know, half an hour is still there to go and win the game. Clearly Solskjaer did not feel that his substitutions, the people on his bench, would make a difference in that game. He thought the 11 that he started, and I think you have to say the 11 that he started felt like the right team, you know.
It was a strong, strong 11. Like, we were both all in the match chat and whatnot, on text and whatnot, saying we thought one of Pogba or one of Marcus Rashford would start. We thought it would be Fred probably in the pivot rather than Scott McTominay. And then to see Solskjaer play everyone, it was a bit surprising, I was going to say. It looked as if he wanted to end that game in 90 minutes, for sure.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah, he obviously has gone there thinking, my players are rested after, you know, being rotated out of the Wolves game, and I'm going to pick my best team that I think can win this game. Fred, he said afterwards, or before actually, that Fred had been a bit injured. So, you know, maybe that was a consideration, but still the team he picked felt like the right one. You know, I know Pogba prefers to be a bit more advanced, but I think he had a few flourishes of passes from deep that really made a bit of a difference. But overall, I don't think he stepped up. You know, I think Marcus Rashford had a difficult game. I think he some of the skill that he did in the first half was outrageous to beat his man. But then I felt like he was trying a bit too much, shooting from distances that weren't really going to be beneficial. I thought Mason Greenwood did pretty well. You know, I thought he was probably the standout attacker for United. Bruno Fernandes didn't have a good game. Scott McTominay was the best performer for me. I know that Solskjaer mentioned after the game that he was his man of the match, and I think the way he carried the ball, he got the ball on the turn in midfield and drove with it, and that troubled Villarreal. You know, you could see chances coming from that, but United never really put a consistency together of those attacking plays in the final third. And that meant that Villarreal could actually, you know, just a bit more comfortable. The pressure wasn't applied. But I think just going back to the substitutions, that is obviously something that you can look at it two ways. Should Solskjaer, I think you have obviously in a recent piece, you know, should Solskjaer rotate his squad more throughout the season so that it doesn't feel like when it comes to a big crunch match like this, the substitution is a step down from what he started with? Or, you know, we've seen when he has rotated that the players that have come in haven't done the job. So a bit of a catch-22 situation there. You know, you've got Donny van de Beek there, who was United's major summer signing last year, £40 million, did not get off the bench with five substitutions. If that isn't a sign that something is wrong with that situation, you know, I don't know what is. You know, was he somebody who Solskjaer absolutely wanted, or was he someone that United could get? And that is the situation that we go into this summer window with. And United need to address that. Again, Ahmad, he showed some really good flourishes against Wolves. And in that training session, you know, that we watched before the final in the Gdansk Stadium, I suppose Solskjaer's thought was, who would I take off to put him on, that I think Ahmad will be a better bet than this player, and he might have to take a penalty. And for an 18-year-old, that is a lot of pressure, I think, you know, at your new club. I think Ahmad seems to have a pretty cool to take such a pressure situation and go with it. But, you know, he was a £37 million player. I'm still going to call him a £37 million player because that was the deal. Yeah. But he was someone for the future. So you spent £80 million on two players last summer who haven't come off the bench in your prestige moment. Something's not right there. Is that Solskjaer not trusting them, or is that they aren't actually good enough to make that difference in that moment?
I would argue it's a bit of both, but I want to throw this over to Andy first, because over the course of this Europa League final build-up, you have spoken about how good Villarreal are. You've had an excellent interview with Dani Parejo, talking about the defensive organisation they have and almost how they almost preferred being the underdog. You said there was going to be a point in time where they can defend as a collective. And that's what we saw in that final. Sort of United played a whole bunch of attackers, all trying to do a bit individual brilliance, but the front three didn't really quite click. Is this a case of Unai Emery doing a tactical masterclass on Solskjaer?
Yes, in so much as he had a game plan. And I spoke to Capoue after the match, and he said his role was to push Bruno Fernandes back. And I think he was quite effective in doing that. I think he was man of the match. And Emery, he studies opponents in meticulous detail. He always has done. He's got an incredible record in this competition. He's won it four times. And when I spoke to Parejo for The Athletic, he said, we're comfortable when we get an advantage, defending that advantage. And as soon as they went ahead, you could see that. And technically, they're excellent. They had two better central defenders than Manchester United have got, probably even when Maguire is fit. You had the experience of Albion, and you had Pau Torres, who's more of a ball-playing defender, one who United have been watching closely. So tactically, it worked for them. And I said to Capoue, what did Emery say to you at half-time? And he just said, carry on with this game plan. It's working. You're going to be put under even more pressure. One thing Pau Torres said to me was the physical side of the United team. That was the most difficult thing for them. You know, if United were playing in La Liga, they would be classed as a very physically strong team. But to the earlier part of the question, it's not the first time that United's attackers, despite being so good when it all clicks, such as against Manchester City away or against PSG, there's been so many times when they struggle to break down teams who defend deeply. And I was watching that Villarreal shape last night, and where Laurie and I sat, we had really privileged positions to be right on top of it. It was quite a tight stadium, even though it was a big stadium. And you could just see them retreat into this block. And they were so comfortable in that. And it wasn't kicking the ball away. In Dani Parejo, you've got a player who is technically better than his equivalents in the same position at Manchester United. So they knew that they were going to have less possession, but they called it right in terms of the substitutions that they made. And even in terms of the fans, the Villarreal fans were louder than the United fans all night. I think they were pretty similar in numbers, but they were better organised. And I don't think you can criticise the United fans because it was so difficult for them to get there. So it was very disparate following, spread out. There was no nucleus, whereas Villarreal is such a small club. All of the hardcore went. So they all knew each other, and they were the ones who were singing throughout the 90 minutes. After 20 minutes, they were singing, Si se puede, yes, we can, yes, we can. And that became the background to the whole game for me, because they just never stopped singing it. And the United fans, after Cavani had scored, were singing, attack, 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 attack. But it was mainly the Villarreal fans. And I just had this sense of foreboding. I didn't write, I didn't tweet it. I just thought, it's just not going to be Manchester United's night, this. And maybe I was going to be completely wrong there. But no, it was deeply frustrating. And the margins are small. A couple more penalty kicks, United trophy, we'd be pumped up with adrenaline. the tone of this podcast would be completely different, but that's how it is at top level sport. And United have now gone 4 years without a trophy, and that's not good enough. Manchester United should be winning trophies. Ollie should be winning trophies.
We'll get into the penalties just a little bit, but let's talk about something that a number of listeners have brought in. One question from Yarek T going about substitutions. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer didn't make a substitution until the 111th minute, and that was to bring on Fred. Laurie, you just mentioned there about how you thought Scott McTominay was a good player and how indeed Solskjaer thought it. Andy, you mentioned the physicality of the English teams there. Watching on television, what I saw after Cavani's goal was a nice period of time between the 70th and 90th minute, which tends to be when United get that comeback victory. United are a very physically fit team. Solskjaer's done really well in terms of periodization. I've talked to him about that before. And you could see in the 70th minute, when Villarreal's legs were beginning to tire, there were more space to open up. And that's when Scott McTominay was able to pick up the ball and drive it a bit more forward. But what we saw was Unai Emery emptied out his subs bench. He made five subs in regular time. He swapped his fullback crucially. So when Mason Greenwood and Marcus Rashford might have eked out some more space, there were fresher legs, less tiring, and that space got immediately closed off. Solskjaer didn't make subs. Villarreal's nickname is the Yellow Submarine. Laurie, should he have seen the signs coming earlier?
I actually got a text from a Liverpool supporting mate on full time just with a video GIF of the Yellow Submarine, which with the Beatles reference, he obviously reveled in. Fair enough, I have sent him a few messages this season when Liverpool have lost at home and asked him if there's any football on TV, so I probably deserved it. I was watching it thinking, I'm not sure who we can bring on to make a difference. At that, in the second half, I thought all the players that were on the pitch were doing enough. I know that some players didn't play their best, but I don't, you know, Rashford scored 20 goals, 13 assists this season or something like that. You know, he's had a good, he can deliver in big moments. And there's been times before where I've thought he probably needs to come off and then he's gone and scored. Bruno Fernandes, likewise. Mason Greenwood, you know, he was looking probably the most threatening. So I was sort of thinking, who do you, and Edison Cavani, you know, he was still running around like a maniac. So I was sort of thinking, who do you take off to then put somebody on? Ahmad? Donny? I mean, Dan James ultimately came on. I feel like with Villarreal, clearly their squad is more even, you know, so it's probably, you know, swapping like for like a bit more. So you are getting fresher legs. And obviously that, you know, that in the extra time, that told because it just meant that it was a non-event really. You know, I know Villarreal probably had a couple of small openings that they didn't really benefit from, but it meant that United couldn't really aggressively attack them. It was a case of sort of it just time elapsing, really. I mean, I didn't. Is it bad that I didn't think Villarreal were that good?
They were beatable. I know I'm going to get a little bit heated. Villarreal are eminently beatable. Etienne Capoue, yes, okay, he was man of match. I'm going to be mildly disrespectful here and say he played for Watford. And I understand Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's approach with substitutes. I've spent many a time looking at his substitute profile. I know he likes to make his first sub in the 62nd, 63rd minute, and I know he likes to bring on the Manu Matic to close things off in the 85th. I know he's a plan A, wait and see, because Greenwood might have an amazing shot or Bruno might do a great pass. I think that works in a league format where eventually everything evens out and one thing or another, your talent shows. I think in a cup competition, that's a weakness. Because the longer a game goes on and you're doing the same thing over and over and over again, when people are getting tired and people are getting frustrated and people are losing faith in their schemes, the less likely it is to happen. You can't quite rely on Manchester United luck all the time. And Solskjaer, while he likes to invoke Manchester United past, Ferguson emptied his subs bench a lot in these cup competitions. The only reason, I mean, I'm not going to say the only reason, one big reason why Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is a hero is because Ferguson emptied his bench in a certain cup competition. So I know you can't say there's no one of similar qualities who bring off the bench, but at some point in time, you do need to make a change. One, just to have fresh legs, so you have someone doing the same plan, but less tired. Or two, to just give Villarreal something new to think about.
Yeah.
There were points where I'm going, remove Pogba and bring on Fred and just go, we'll just put that base on and try and do more counter-attacks, or indeed remove Matt Rashford, who was not having a great game, and move Pogba to the left and say, if they want to play in a low block, we'll just move Pogba, one of our best passers, so we can make better passes closer to the penalty area. I'm making myself sad here. Andy, please. Am I making sense?
You are, and your point about Capoue is a good one. He played for Watford. Actually, I think him and Decore were the best players when Watford last came to Old Trafford. They did really well. But we're talking to someone here who was a fringe player at Tottenham Hotspur, who looked last night that all of his dreams had come true. And if Manchester United would have had Keane in the middle and Scholes, would Capoue have been man of the match? I think you're leading back into an issue there about the technical levels. Although I thought Scott McTominay was probably United's best player. I think his drive was really impressive. Too many of the players didn't turn up. And we can big up or talk down Villarreal. The fact is, they are the seventh best team in Spain. United mm-hmm. have easily got past teams around them in the league. Real Sociedad finished higher than them. United put four past. Granada, United got past them pretty comfortably. It's not like United have played Atletico Madrid in the final.
Victory in this final takes Villarreal from the Europa Conference next season into the Champions League. That's quite a little feat there.
You're right though, Carl. I mean, it's, you know, and Andy's right in terms of saying, you know, seventh best team in the league. This United should be beating these teams. You know, their team, their squad cost the sixth of United's. You know, you talk about financials and ultimately who has the most money usually wins stuff. And in this situation, United have failed. Solskjaer, to be fair to him afterwards, was open about that. Not a successful season, no bones about it. I suppose it's one thing acknowledging that and understanding that and appreciating that. It's another thing to then be able to do something to address it. And yeah, I think you're right on the substitutions. Try something different. He needs to get to a situation next season where it is a more equitable share amongst the first team players and squad. You know, to have really sort of 14, 15 first team players that you could pick and be, yeah, they're genuine first teamers. It was a similar situation really last season against Sevilla, you know, when he didn't mm-hmm. make any subs because he basically didn't think he could change anything from the bench. And that's why he wanted Sancho, you know. That's probably why he still wants Sancho. But, you know, United added Edinson Cavani to that squad and Donny van de Beek. That's where we are. So, you know, Anthony Martial's injured. So it's basically a sort of rinse and repeat from Sevilla. It needs to be different next season. I accept that Solskjaer has questions to answer, and I think he will ask himself those questions. I think that's one thing that I do admire about him, that he's not above, he doesn't doubt himself. He's got very strong self-belief and confidence, but he will look at decisions that he's made with open eyes and see if he needs to adjust anything.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
From substitutions to penalties, Yannick T also asks, why was David Gea not substituted ahead of the penalty shootout? He's only ever saved one penalty versus Arsenal at the start of his career. Solskjaer put on Mata and Telles on to take penalties, but not Henderson to save them. This was, I mean, a heart-wrenching penalty shootout for me. I was stood up, knelt down, rolling around the floor. Couldn't quite get my head around it. Laurie, what was it like in the stadium? What was the conversation around Bruno Fernandes opting to go second after winning the coin toss?
Yes, there's two points there, isn't there? There's Bruno Fernandes going second and there's David De Gea being the guy in between the sticks. I will slightly correct Yarick. De Gea did save a penalty against Everton in the FA Cup. Romelu Lukaku, it was a really good save, actually. That was 2016. But his point stands that since that moment, De Gea has faced, and admittedly now it's another 11 from last night, but he's faced 40 penalties for club and country and he's not saved them. And last night he didn't look like he was going to save them. He looked short of self-belief. And when penalties are such a psychological game between taker and saver, hopefully, giving that presence, making the guy that's stepping up to try and take something, have that doubt, to make him think you're going to save it. You've got to do some stuff. You know, you've got to give that impression. And it looked like he was uncertain, you know, dived out of the way. We could see from our stands that he was looking at his towel, and I was thinking, is he looking for some divine intervention? Is there, you know, a shroud in there that you know, we can't quite make out? But obviously then it transpired that he had notes on these penalty takers where they preferred to go. And I've not gone back through it all exactly, but, you know, checked a couple, and he doesn't follow the instructions on a couple. And a few of them were central, you know, and I was thinking there on the night saying, just stay in the middle and see what happens. You know, he dived out the way of a few, and you're thinking, okay, it's gone, you know, he's not got any close to it. But if he'd have stayed there, would he have made the kicker do something different? You know, would he have made the kicker try and put it more in the corner and then he hits the post or something? I think back to Dean Henderson's sort of penalty save. It wasn't really a save, but against Real Sociedad, and the player that took the penalty had scored his previous 16, and he does a shuffle, and but De Gea sort of, Henderson sort of stays there, and he balloons it over the bar. And, you know, it's that kind of cat and mouse, almost a game of poker that you kind of want your goalkeeper to have presence on. And De Gea just didn't seem to have it. I found it curious that you had Bruno Fernandes, Edison Cavani, Axel Tuanzebe go over to him after they'd scored their penalties and really engage him in conversation as if they were G'ing him up, like as if they felt that he needed this kind of coddling approach to please, you know, you can do it, have faith. There was Richard Hartis near the dugout. He was sort of making eye contact with De Gea and kind of holding up one finger as if to say, we just need one save, you know, which it transpired was the case. United scored 10 penalties and lost a penalty shootout. You know, it's really, you know, it's unheard of, really. And then that brings me on to your question about Bruno Fernandes, which is something I hadn't noticed. You know, there's lots going on. Our editor, Alex Kajelski, calls me up and said, Bruno chose to go second. And I'm thinking, no, please, that can't be the case. But it did confuse me that United were going second and in front of the Villarreal fans. But you take two different coin tosses, fine. But yeah, given the choice of when to go, he chose second. The referee I could not get my head around a lot of his decisions last night, the referee, but on this one,
a little strange he was.
Referee Clement Turpin from France. Some of his calls were very odd, but he himself, you know, realised that Fernandes perhaps was making a mistake because he asked him again to just double check. Fernandes, they obviously didn't know. So you know, there's a statistic out there. There's been research done that you have a 60% chance of winning a penalty shootout if you go first. We're sort of back to that 60% confidence, Andy. so maybe Villarreal had the 60% confidence once you know, they were going first. And that's why, you know, that new system was trialed, the ABBA system, you know, one team takes one, then the next team takes two, then two, you know, like in tennis. You know, it hasn't stuck around, but you know, clearly there's a reason why teams like to go first. United went first in 2008 and that proved successful. And it just meant that every time a United player passed the fourth penalty, so I think seven takers, they had to score to stay in the competition. And that is an acute mm-hmm. pressure. It's a different pressure to being level and trying to score to go ahead. You know, you know you've got a kind of insurance policy with your keeper, unless he's David De Gea, trying to save a penalty in the next one. Sorry, that was a bit cheap. But, you know, so it's a different pressure. And you could see that with Luke Shaw, for example. His penalty was, you know, tinged with anxiety, I think. He was really relieved. You could see when Geronimo Rulli didn't quite make it. That was one of the occasions twice Villarreal players in the halfway line started to set off to sprint in celebration because they thought the goalkeeper went the right way. It was for Fred the first time, but his penalty was really good, you know, powerful. Shaw's was a little bit close to the bone. Third time lucky, they set off sprinting when David De Gea went to that side again. Rulli saved it. And yeah, those moments, would they have made a difference? I don't know. Would Bruno Fernandes saying, yeah, we want to go first, have then added a little bit of anxiety into a Villarreal player who, you know, would do something? We don't know, do we? But it's those decisions about De Gea, about when to take a penalty, in hindsight, you look back and think, what if?
Hindsight is a fascinating beast. I will tell you what I thought throughout that shootout. My first thought was, in the early setup, I thought, oh, they're putting all the penalties down the middle. De Gea needs to figure out what's going on. Then I had a moment that I think quite a few fans had, which was go, Fred? Really confused. And then when he scored, I went, Fred! Going, thank you very much. I think I had a similar feeling when Axel Tuanzebe stepped up. He didn't look as if he'd score, and then he scored. I quite enjoyed Marcus Rashford's expression of emotion after scoring his penalty. You could see that meant a lot as well. And then I'd say, I think after the eighth, maybe seventh penalty, I thought, De Gea is not going to save one of these. I had a terrible feeling going, he's not going to save any of these penalties. We're now relying on a Villarreal player to blaze one over the bar or hit the post. Andy, what were your feelings watching that shootout?
What was the referee's name again, Laurie?
Have I got it? So you're going to make a joke about Turpin? Dick Turpin.
Yeah. It all starts to make sense now. We've got Dick Turpin's son refereeing the match. I hated the penalties. I didn't enjoy them at all. I felt United were under pressure by electing to go second. The penalties were exceptional from both teams. It was just awful watching it. I had a Villarreal fan to my right going absolutely crazy every time they put one in. You're right to make the point about David De Gea's poor record saving penalties. And there was an odd bounce from where I was sat for the goal, but he didn't have that much to do for the rest of the game. In hindsight, would it have been better to bring Henderson on for the penalties? I mean, who knows? It's just so easy in football to be Harry Hindsight. And 20 penalties were scored, and then De Gea took one against the person who I felt was probably the weakest player on the pitch, Rui, and he ends up making the key save and then they win the Europa League. It's not a fair way to decide a football game. Was I complaining in Moscow when Manchester United beat Chelsea on penalties? Not at all. Some you win, some you lose, and it feels absolutely awful when you lose them. I've seen Manchester United win European finals and felt that elation. And I was there in Rome, I was there at Wembley, and I was in Gdansk. And it's just a sickening feeling to come so far in pretty challenging circumstances this season with the pandemic and to lose the game at the last. The margins are indeed fine.
This is a slightly morbid question from me, Andy, but you've been to some European final defeats. How does this one compare right now?
Barcelona in 2009 was the most gutting for me because I took my mum. My mum's an Old Trafford girl, and Barca battered United, and also I told all Barca fans, and I've been on the Catalan media saying you shouldn't be so cocksure. And then 2 years later, I did exactly the same thing, and was on Catalan TV saying United have learned their lesson from Rome, and Barca were even better in the 2011 final, probably the best performance I've seen against Manchester United. So to lose a Champions League final hurts more than losing a Europa League final. But if you're asking me how I feel today, I feel absolutely crap. But that's probably a combination of a lack of adrenaline, a lack of sleep, and just this big come down. Because if United would have won the competition, we'd be saying second Europa League, build on this. The outlook would be completely different, but it's not, and it's as miserable as the weather in Gdansk or some of the industrial buildings which were close to the stadium, which were anything but prettified like in the centre of the city. Look, to be a football fan, you've got to experience the bad moments to truly enjoy the good moments. And as Manchester United fans, we have been spoiled with success. Villarreal have never even been to a final before. It's not a team that wins trophies, but expectations are not unreasonable because of Manchester United's support, because of their outlay, because of the salaries that the players are on. But nah, it just feels crap, and I'm not going to dress it up any other way. And we're there as supporters, as journalists, we're invested in it, but we weren't on the pitch, and a lot of people I think will be suffering today.
Well said, Andy. some astute observations on what's been a interesting season. Laurie, I want to get your thoughts here. Was asked, can you count the season as a success? And he gave a pretty curt no. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, I'd agree with him. And same as Andy, you know, Europa League success would have meant silverware, and it would have been a moment to cherish. Solskjaer, May 26th in front of Fergie, you know, it was all lined up, wasn't it? As it happened, it's extremely disappointing. And, you know, look at the Premier League season. They've added 8 points onto last season. That's fine. That's decent. But next season is going to be a real barometer. What I did quite enjoy was, enjoy probably is the wrong word, reflect on in a pleasing way, is Solskjaer's work in the press conference afterwards. I think he gave honest answers. I think he it came across with conviction. It wasn't nervous. I sort of half suspected that he might be a little bit uncertain as to what to say, but actually he had clear thoughts in his mind. He obviously spoke about the need to add in the summer, but he also spoke on a human level. I think that's something that he's done really well this season. He's understood his players in a difficult situation, and he spoke about going away. Now you can either go on holiday and do nothing and kind of feel sorry for yourself, or you can come back ready, refreshed, with a drive to start the season well, because they didn't start the season well, did they? Obviously, there's mitigating factors for that, but he very plainly wants this an opportunity to go for players to reflect and to come back stronger. You know, defeat, they can actually emerge a better unit, better people. And I think to that end, to be fair, Marcus Rashford's interview to BT Sport afterwards was extremely compelling. Yeah, as we've said, he didn't have his best game, but he spoke from the heart afterwards. You could tell it was off the cuff, but it was, you know, said with real meaning about this kind of thing. You know, we will not quit. And yes, it's easy to say that in the aftermath of a game, but clearly the pain was still there. He could have shirked it. And you could tell that was it was a moment to go, okay, right, he's serious here. You know, this isn't something that, you know, players aren't going to be, you know, throwing the toys out the pram and thinking, yeah, this isn't for me anymore. This was a very firm flag in the ground moment from Rashford, and I thought it was great to hear. So that at least gives a bit of comfort going into the summer.
I'm trying. It's okay. It's not bad. Second place, Champions League football has been secured. Things will look up. Andy, please give me some reason to be encouraged today.
I know that Ollie feels that he's got to bring at least two proven, ready to play, ready to star players in. Not squad players, not ones who are hopes for the future. Bruno class players who can come in and help transform a team, which you could argue he's taken to his limit because they're deficient when compared to Manchester City. I think there's a fine line now. I think it's a really important summer. United have got to recruit well this summer. No ifs or buts. Pick the mood back up off the floor. Start next season well, which they weren't able to do this season because of a lack of pre-season. Big summer for John Murta. Big summer for Darren Fletcher. Big summer for the Glazer family, who've got to put money in. And there's got to be signings that excite the fans. We can't be having the stop-start transfer window, which moved into this summer. United have got to make a couple of statements. That's what the manager wants. He's the manager. You've given him the job. Now you've got to give him more of the tools to do the job, to continue to make the improvements. And it's all right saying there's 10 very exciting youth prospects who are going to be ready in 3 years' time. They're not ready now. And United will be judged for now more intensely next season, because in December, Ollie will have been in the job for 3 years and he's not got a trophy to his name. He needs to start winning trophies.
The tools are almost all there, and United can and have been building to something special. We can only hope that next season, that won the big one. Other than that, thank you, Laurie, and thank you, Andy, to help me with this slightly downbeat Europa League final. I want to congratulate you both for not swearing, even though we did pull some very sad faces during the recording. Andy, I'm going to let you go first because I know you need to get some sleep. So thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Laurie. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And thank you, Laurie. It's been an amazing season covering Manchester United with you.
Cheers, Carl. Yes, absolutely. Let's hope the next season is even better.
And thank you, listener, for joining us for Talk of Devils. This has been the Manchester United podcast brought to you from The Athletic. We'll be back with trophies one day.
The Athletic.